This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. Written by Jack Weatherford. Narrated by Jonathan Davis.
This noble king was called Genghis Khan, who in his time was of so great renown that there was nowhere, in no region, so excellent a lord in all things. Geoffrey Chaucer, The Squire's Tale, The Canterbury Tales, circa 1395. Part 1. The Reign of Terror on the Steppe, 1162 to 1206. Nations. What are nations? Tartars and Huns and Chinamen. Like insects they swarm. The historian strives in vain to make them memorable. It is for want of a man that there are so many men. It is individuals that populate the world. Henry David Thoreau. Journal entry for May 1st, 1851. Chapter 1. The Blood Clot. There is fire in his eyes, and light in his face. The Secret History of the Mongols. Of the thousands of cities conquered by the Mongols, history only mentions one that Genghis Khan deigned to enter. Usually, when victory became assured, he withdrew with his court to a distant and more pleasant camp while his warriors completed their tasks. On a March day in 1220, the year of the dragon, the Mongol conqueror broke with his peculiar tradition by leading his cavalry into the center of the newly conquered city of Bukhara, one of the most important cities belonging to the Sultan of Khwarizm, in what is now Uzbekistan. Although neither the capital nor the major commercial city, Bukhara occupied an exalted emotional position throughout the Muslim world as Noble Bukhara, the center of religious piety known by the epithet, the ornament and delight to all Islam. Knowing fully the propaganda value of his actions by conquering and entering the city, Genghis Khan rode triumphantly through the city gates, past the warren of wooden houses and vendor stalls, to the large cluster of stone and brick buildings at the center of the city. His entry into Bukhara followed the successful conclusion of possibly the most audacious surprise attack in military history. While one part of his army took the direct route from Mongolia to attack the Sultan's border cities head-on, he had secretly pulled and pushed another division of warriors over a distance longer than any other army had ever covered, 2,000 miles of desert, mountains, and steppe, to appear deep behind enemy lines, where least expected. Even trade caravans avoided the Kizil Kum, the fabled Red Desert, by detouring hundreds of miles to avoid it. And that fact, of course, was precisely why Genghis Khan chose to attack from that direction. By befriending the nomads of the area, he was able to lead his army on a hitherto unknown track through the stone and sand desert. His targeted city of Bukhara stood at the center of a fertile oasis, astride one of the tributaries of the Amu Darya, inhabited mostly by Tajik or Persian people, but ruled by Turkic tribesmen in the newly created empire of Khwarizm, one of the many transitory empires of the era. The Sultan of Khwarizm had, in a grievously fatal mistake, provoked the enmity of Genghis Khan by looting a Mongol trade caravan and disfiguring the faces of Mongol ambassadors sent to negotiate peaceful commerce. Although nearly 60 years old, when Genghis Khan heard of the attack on his men, he did not hesitate to summon his disciplined and experienced army once again to their mounts and to charge down the road of war. In contrast to almost every major army in history, the Mongols traveled lightly, without a supply train. by waiting until the coldest months to make the desert crossing. Men and horses required less water. Dew also formed during this season, thereby stimulating the growth of some grass that provided grazing for horses and attracted game that the men eagerly hunted for their own sustenance. Instead of transporting slow-moving siege engines and heavy equipment with them, the Mongols carried a faster-moving engineer corps that could build whatever was needed on the spot from available materials. When the Mongols came to the first trees after crossing the vast desert, they cut them down and made them into ladders, siege engines, and other instruments for their attack. When the advance guard spotted the first small settlement after leaving the desert, the rapidly moving detachment immediately changed pace, moving now in a slow lumbering procession, as though they were merchants coming to trade, rather than with the speed of warriors on the attack. The hostile force nonchalantly ambled up to the gates of the town before the residents realized who they were and sounded an alarm. Upon emerging unexpectedly from the desert, Genghis Khan did not race to attack Bukhara immediately. He knew that no reinforcements could leave the border cities under attack by his army, and he therefore had time to play on the surprise in a tortured manipulation of public fear and hope. The objective of such tactics was simple and always the same: to frighten the enemy into surrendering before an actual battle began. By first capturing several small towns in the vicinity, Genghis Khan's army set many local people to flight under Bukhara as refugees, who not only filled the city, but greatly increased the level of terror in it. By striking deeply behind the enemy lines, the Mongols immediately created havoc and panic throughout the kingdom. As the Persian chronicler Atta Malik Juveni described his approach, when the people saw the countryside all around them choked with horsemen and the air black as night with the dust of cavalry, fright and panic overcame them, and fear and dread prevailed. In preparing the psychological attack on the city, Genghis Khan began with two examples of what awaited the people. He offered generous terms of surrender to the outlying communities, and the ones that accepted the terms and joined the Mongols received great leniency. In the words of the Persian chronicler, "Whoever yields and submits to them is safe and free from the terror and disgrace of their severity." Those that refused received exceptionally harsh treatment, as the Mongols herded the captives before them to be used as cannon fodder in the next attack. The tactic panicked the Turkic defenders of Bukhara. Leaving only about 500 soldiers behind to man the citadel of Bukhara, the remaining army of 20,000 soldiers fled in what they thought was still time before the main Mongol army arrived. By abandoning their fortress and dispersing in flight, they sprung Genghis Khan's trap. And the Mongol warriors, who were already stationed in wait for the fleeing soldiers, cut them down at a nearly leisurely pace. The civilian population of Bukhara surrendered and opened the city gates. But the small contingent of defiant soldiers remained in their citadel, where they hoped that the massive walls would allow them to hold out indefinitely against any siege. To more carefully assess the overall situation, Genghis Khan made his unprecedented decision to enter the city. One of his first acts on reaching the center of Bukhara, or upon accepting the surrender of any people, was to summon them to bring fodder for his horses. Feeding the Mongol warriors and their horses was taken as a sign of submission by the conquered. More important, by receiving the food and fodder, Genghis Khan signaled his acceptance of the people as vassals, entitled to Mongol protection as well as subject to his command. From the time of his Central Asian conquests, we have one of the few written descriptions of Genghis Khan, who was about 60 years old. The Persian chronicler Minhaj al-Siraj Juzjani, who was far less kindly disposed toward the Mongols than the chronicler Juveni, described him as a man of tall stature, of vigorous build, robust in body, the hair on his face scanty and turned white, with cat's eyes, possessed of dedicated energy, discernment, genius, and understanding, awe-striking, a butcher, just, resolute, an overthrower of enemies, intrepid, sanguinary, and cruel. Because of his uncanny ability to destroy cities and conquer armies many times the size of his own, the chronicler also goes on to declare that Genghis Khan was adept at magic and deception, and some of the devils were his friends. Eyewitnesses reported that upon reaching the center of Bukhara, Genghis Khan rode up to the large mosque and asked if, since it was the largest building in the city, it was the home of the Sultan. When informed that it was the house of God, not the Sultan, he said nothing. For the Mongols, the one God was the eternal blue sky that stretched from horizon to horizon in all four directions. God presided over the whole earth. He could not be cooped up in a house of stone like a prisoner or a caged animal. Nor, as the city people claimed, could his words be captured and confined inside the covers of a book. In his own experience, Genghis Khan had often felt the presence and heard the voice of God speaking directly to him in the vast open air of the mountains in his homeland, and by following those words, he had become the conqueror of great cities and huge nations. Genghis Khan dismounted from his horse in order to walk into the great mosque, the only such building he is known to have ever entered in his life. Upon entering, he ordered that the scholars and clerics feed his horses, freeing them from further danger and placing them under his protection, as he did with almost all religious personnel who came under his control. Next, he summoned the 280 richest men of the city to the mosque. Despite his limited experience inside city walls, Genghis Khan still had a keen grasp of the working of human emotion and sentiment. Before the assembled men in the mosque, Genghis Khan took a few steps up the pulpit stairs, then turned to face the elite of Bukhara. Through interpreters, he lectured them sternly on the sins and misdeeds of their sultan and themselves. It was not the common people who were to blame for these failures. Rather, it is the great ones among you who have committed these sins. If you had not committed great sins, God would not have sent a punishment like me upon you. He then gave each rich man into the control of one of his Mongol warriors, who would go with him and collect his treasure. He admonished his rich prisoners not to bother showing them the wealth above the ground. The Mongols could find that without assistance. He wanted them to guide them only to their hidden or buried treasure. Having begun the systematic plundering of the city, Genghis Khan turned his attention to attacking the Turkic warriors still defiantly sealed inside the citadel of Bukhara. Although not familiar with the Mongols in particular, the people in the urbanized oases of Central Asian cities like Bukhara and Samarkand had seen many barbarian armies come and go through the centuries. Prior tribal armies, no matter how brave or disciplined, never posed a severe threat, because urban armies, so long as they had food and water, could hold out indefinitely behind the massive walls of their forts. By most measures, the Mongols should have been no match for the professionally trained career soldiers they encountered at Bukhara. Although the Mongols had excellent bows in general, each man was responsible for making or acquiring his own, and the quality of workmanship varied. Similarly, the Mongol army was composed of all the males of the tribe, who depended on the ruggedness of their upbringing herding animals for their training. And while they were hardly disciplined and devoted to their tasks, they lacked the professional selection and training of the defenders of Bukhara. The greatest factor in favor of the soldiers holed up behind the massive stone walls of the citadel was that no tribal army had ever mastered the complex technology of siege warfare. But Genghis Khan had something to show them. The attack was designed as a show of overwhelming strength for which the audience was not the already conquered people of Bukhara, but the still distant army and people of Samarkand, the next city on his march. The Mongol invaders rolled up their newly constructed siege engines, catapults, trebuchets, and mangonels that hurled not only stones and fire, as besieging armies had done for centuries, but also pots of burning liquids, exploding devices, and incendiary materials. They maneuvered immense crossbows mounted on wheels, and great teams of men pushed in portable towers with retractable ladders from which they could shoot down at the defenders of the walls. At the same time that they attacked through the air, miners went to work digging into the earth to undermine the walls by sapping. During this awesome display of technological prowess in the air, on the land, and beneath the earth, Genghis Khan heightened the psychological tension by forcing prisoners, in some cases the captured comrades of the men still in the citadel, to rush forward until their bodies filled the moat and made live ramparts over which other prisoners pushed the engines of war. The Mongols devised and used weapons from the different cultures with whom they had contact, and through this accumulation of knowledge, they created a global arsenal that could be adapted to whatever situation they encountered. In their flaming and exploding weapons, the Mongols experimented with early forms of armaments that would later become mortars and cannons. In the description of Juveni, we sense the confusion of the witnesses in accounting for exactly what happened around them. He described the Mongol assault as like a red-hot furnace fed from without by hard sticks thrust into the recesses, while from the belly of the furnace, sparks shoot into the air. Genghis Khan's army combined the traditional fierceness and speed of the steppe warrior with the highest technological sophistication of Chinese civilization. Genghis Khan used his fast-moving and well-trained cavalry against the enemy's infantry on the ground, while negating the protective power of the fortress walls with the new technology of bombardment, using firepower and unprecedented machines of destruction to penetrate the fortress and terrorize its defenders. With fire and death raining down on the men in the citadel, the warriors of the Sultan, in Juveni's words, quickly drowned in the sea of annihilation. Genghis Khan recognized that warfare was not a sporting contest or a mere match between rivals. It was a total commitment of one people against another. Victory did not come to the one who played by the rules. It came to the one who made the rules and imposed them on his enemy. Triumph could not be partial. It was complete, total, and undeniable, or it was nothing. In battle, this meant the unbridled use of terror and surprise. In peace, it meant the steadfast adherence to a few basic but unwavering principles that created loyalty among the common people. Resistance would be met with death, loyalty with security. His attack on Bukhara ranked as a success, not merely because the people of that city surrendered, but because when word of the Mongol campaign reached the capital of Samarkand, that army surrendered as well. The Sultan fled his kingdom, and the Mongol juggernaut pushed onward. Genghis Khan himself took the main part of the army across the mountains of Afghanistan and on to the Indus River. While another detachment circled around the Caspian Sea, through the Caucasus Mountains, and onto the plains of Russia. For precisely 700 years, from that day in 1220 until 1920, when the Soviets moved in, Genghis Khan's descendants ruled as Khans and Emirs over the city of Bukhara in one of the longest family dynasties in history. Genghis Khan's ability to manipulate people and technology represented the experienced knowledge of more than four decades of nearly constant warfare. At no single crucial moment in his life did he suddenly acquire his genius at warfare, his ability to inspire the loyalty of his followers, or his unprecedented skill for organizing on a global scale. These derived not from epiphanic enlightenment or formal schooling, but from a persistent cycle of pragmatic learning, experimental adaptation, and constant revision driven by his uniquely disciplined mind and focused will. His fighting career began long before most of his warriors at Bukhara had been born, and in every battle he learned something new. In every skirmish, he acquired more followers and additional fighting techniques. In each struggle, he combined the new ideas into a constantly changing set of military tactics, strategies, and weapons. He never fought the same war twice. The story of the boy who was destined to become the world's greatest conqueror began six decades before the Mongol conquest of Bukhara, in one of the most remote places in the inner expanse of Eurasia, near the border of modern Mongolia and Siberia. According to legend, the Mongols originated in the mountain forest when blue-gray wolf mated with beautiful red doe on the shores of a great lake. Because the Mongols permanently closed this homeland to outsiders when Genghis Khan died, we have no historical descriptions of it. The names of its rivers and mountains are virtually unknown in the historical literature, and even modern maps give conflicting names to its features, in a great variety of spellings. This territory of the Mongol clans occupied only a small part in the northeast of the country now known as Mongolia. Most of the country now spreads across a high plateau in north-central Asia, beyond the range of the Pacific Ocean's moisture-bearing winds that water the lush coastal plains of Asia's agricultural civilizations. By contrast, the winds that reach the Mongolian plateau mostly blow from the Arctic in the northwest. These winds release what little moisture they carry onto the northern mountains and leave the southern part of the country dry, a terrain known as Govi, or to foreigners, as the Gobi. Between the harsh Gobi and the moderately watered mountains to the north lie vast stretches of steppe that turn green in the summer if they get rain. It is along these steppes that the herders move in the summer, searching for grass. Although reaching only about 10,000 feet above sea level, Mongolia's Henti mountain range consists of some of the oldest mountains on the planet. Unlike the jagged, youthful Himalayas, which can only be ascended with climbing gear, the ancient Henti mountains have been smoothed by millions of years of erosion, so that with only moderate difficulty, a horse and rider can reach all but a few of the peaks in summer. Marshes dot their sides. In the long winter, these freeze into a solid mass. The deeper indentations in the mountainsides collect snow and water that freeze into what looks like glaciers in the winter, but in the brief summer, they turn into beautiful lakes of cobalt blue. The spring thaw of ice and snow overflows the lakes and spills off the mountains to form a series of small rivers that flow out onto the steppe that in the best of summers shimmers with grass as green as emeralds, but in the worst of times can remain a burned brown for several consecutive years. The rivers that flow out of the Henti Mountains are small and remain frozen for much of the year, even in May, when the ice is usually thick enough to support a team of mounted horses and sometimes even a loaded jeep. The long, broad steps that stretch out along these small rivers served as the highways for the Mongols toward the various regions of Eurasia. Spurs of this grassland reach west, all the way into Hungary and Bulgaria in Eastern Europe. To the east, they reach Manchuria, and would touch the Pacific Ocean, if not barred by a thin ridge of coastal mountains that cut off the Korean Peninsula. On the southern side of the Gobi, the grasslands slowly pick up again and join the heart of the Asian continent, connecting with the extensive agricultural plains of the Yellow River. Despite the gentle roll of the landscape, the weather can be fierce and changes abruptly. This is a land of marked extremes, where humans and their animals face constant challenges from the weather. The Mongols say that you can experience all four seasons in a single day in the Henti. Even in May, a horse might sink into snowbanks so deep that it could barely keep its head up. On this, the land by the side of the Onon River, the boy, destined to become known as Genghis Khan, was born. In contrast to the natural beauty of the place, its human history was already one of constant strife and hardship long before he was born in the spring of 1162, the year of the horse by the Asian calendar. On an isolated and bald hillock overlooking the remote Onon River, Oilun, a young kidnapped girl, struggled to give birth to him, her first child. Surrounded by strangers, Oilun labored far away from the family that had raised her and the world she knew. This place was not her home, and the man who now claimed her as his wife was not the man whom she had married. Only a short time before, her destiny had seemed so different. She had been the wife of another young warrior, Chilid, of the Merkid tribe. He had traveled to the eastern steppe to find and woo her from the Olhunud, a tribe noted for the beauty of its women. According to steppe tradition, he would have given her parents gifts and worked for them, perhaps for several years, before taking their daughter back to his tribe as his bride. Once married, the two had set out alone for the trek of many weeks back to his homeland. According to the secret history, she rode in a small black cart pulled by an ox or a yak, and her proud husband rode beside the cart on his dun horse. Oilun was probably no more than 16 years old. They traveled easily over the steppe, following the course of the Onon River, and then prepared to enter the mountainous range that divided them from the Merkid lands. Only a few hard days of travel through the isolated mountain valleys lay ahead of them, before they would drop down into the fertile grassland of the Merkid's herds. The young bride sat in the front of her small black cart, unaware of the horsemen about to swoop down upon her, a violent assault that would not only forever change her life, but alter the course of world history. A solitary horseman out hunting with his falcon looked down on Oilun and Chilid from his unobserved perch at the top of a nearby cliff. Oilun and her cart promised greater game than he would capture with his bird. Without letting the newlywed see him, the hunter rode back to his camp to find his two brothers. Too poor to afford the presents necessary to make a marriage with a wife such as Oilun, and perhaps unwilling to perform the traditional bride service for her parents, the hunter chose the second most common way of obtaining a wife on the steppes. Kidnapping. The three brothers set out in pursuit of their unsuspecting prey. As they swooped down toward the couple, Chilid immediately galloped off to draw the attackers away from the cart, and as expected, they chased after him. He tried in vain to lose them by circling around the base of the mountain to return to his bride. But even then, Oilun knew that her husband had not fooled the attackers, not on their own land, and that they would soon be back. Although only a teenage girl, she decided that in order to give her husband a chance to live, she must stay and surrender to her kidnappers. If she fled with Chiled on one horse, they would be captured and he would be killed. But if he fled alone, only she would be captured. The secret history recounts that to convince her husband to cooperate with her plan, she told him, "If you but live, there will be maidens for you on every front and in every cart. You can find another woman to be your bride, and you can call her Oilun in place of me." Oilun then quickly slipped out of her blouse and commanded her new husband to flee quickly. She thrust her blouse into his face as a parting gesture and said, "Take this with you, so that you may have the smell of me with you as you go." Smell holds a deep, important place within steppe culture. Where people in other cultures might hug or kiss at meeting or departing, the steppe nomads sniff one another in a gesture much like a kiss on the cheek. Smelling carries deeply emotional meanings on different levels that vary from the familial sniff between parent and child to the erotic sniff between lovers. Each person's breath and unique body aroma is thought to constitute a part of that person's soul. By thrusting her blouse at her husband, Oilun offered him a deeply important reminder of her love. After that day, Oilun would have a long and eventful life ahead of her, but she was indeed destined never again to see her first love. As he fled his wife's kidnappers, Chiled clutched her blouse to his face and turned back to look at her so many times that his long black braids beat like whips back and forth from his chest to his shoulders. As she saw her husband ride over the pass and slip forever from her sight, Oilun gave vent to the full emotion of her heart. She screamed out so loudly, according to the secret history, that she stirred up the Onon River and shook the woods and valley. Her captor, and the man destined to be her new husband, was Yesuge, of the small and insignificant band that would one day be known as the Mongols. But at this time, he was simply a member of the Borijin clan, subservient to the more powerful Tayichud relatives. Even more troubling for Oilun than the status of her captor was that he already had a wife or concubine, Sochigul, and a son with her. Oilun would have to struggle for her position within the family. If she was lucky, the two women probably lived in separate gurs. The domed tent homes, made of felt blankets tied around a lattice framework, but they would have been in close daily proximity, even if not in the same gur. Oilun grew up on the wide open grassland, where one could see over vast expanses in any direction, and where great herds of horses, cows, sheep, and goats grazed and grew fat during the summer. She was accustomed to the abundant and rich diet of meat and milk offered by the life of the steppe. By contrast, the small tribe of her new husband subsisted on the northern edge of the herding world, where the steppes pushed up against the wooded mountains, without enough grassland to feed large herds. She would now have to eat harsher hunters' foods, marmots, rats, birds, fish, and the occasional deer or antelope. The Mongols claim no ancient and glorious history among the steppe tribes. They were considered scavengers, who competed with the wolves to hunt down the small animals, and, when the opportunity arose, steal animals and women from the herders of the steppe. Oilun would rank as little more than captured chattel by them. According to an often repeated account, Oilun's first baby supposedly struggled into the world, tightly clutching something mysterious and ominous in the fingers of his right hand. Gently, but nervously, his young mother pried back his fingers one by one to find a large black blood clot the size of a knuckle bone. From somewhere in his mother's warm womb, this boy had grasped the blood clot and brought it with him, from that world into this one. What could an inexperienced, illiterate, and terribly lonely young girl make of this strange sign in her son's hand? More than 8 centuries later, we still struggle to answer the same questions that she had about her son. Did the blood clot represent a prophecy or a curse? Did it foretell good fortune or evil? Should she be proud or alarmed? Hopeful or fearful? In the 12th century, dozens of tribes and clans lived on the steppe in, as is characteristic of nomadic people, shifting combinations. Of all the steppe tribes, the Mongols' closest relatives were Tatars and Khitan to the east, the Manchus yet farther to the east, and the Turkic tribes of Central Asia to the west. These three ethnic groups shared a common cultural and linguistic heritage with some of the tribes of Siberia, where they possibly all originated. Located between the Tatars and the Turkic tribes, with whom outsiders often confused them, the Mongols were sometimes known as Blue Turks, or as Black Tatars. As speakers of Altaic languages, named for the Altai mountain range in western Mongolia, their languages bore a distant similarity with Korean and Japanese, but none with Chinese or the other tonal languages of Asia. Although the Turkic tribes and Tatars had coalesced into several tribal confederacies, the Mongols were divided into many small bands, headed by a chief or khan, and loosely based on kinship ties. The Mongols themselves claim a distinct identity from the Turkic and Tatar groups. They asserted, then and now, a direct descent from the Huns, who founded the first empire on the high steppe in the 3rd century. Hun is the Mongolian word for human being, and they called their Hun ancestors Hanu, the people of the sun. In the 4th and 5th centuries, the Huns spread out from the Mongolian steppes to conquer countries from India to Rome. But they were unable to sustain contact among the various clans, and were quickly assimilated into the cultures they conquered. Shortly after he had kidnapped Oylun, Yesuge had gone on a campaign against the Tatars and killed a warrior called Temujin Ug. Returning just after the birth of his son, he named the boy Temujin. Since people of the steppe received only one name in life, its selection carried much symbolism, often on several levels. The name imparted to the child its character, fate, and destiny. The bestowal of the name Temujin may have stressed the lingering enmity between Mongols and Tatars. But much scholarly and imaginative discussion has surrounded the precise meaning of Temujin's name, or what was being conferred upon him by his father. The best hint of the intended meaning comes from the Mongol practice of giving several children names derived from a common root word. Of her 4 subsequent children born after Temujin, Oylun's youngest son bore the name Temug, and the youngest child and only daughter was named Temulun. All 3 names seem to have the common root of the verb temul, which occurred in several Mongol words, meaning to rush headlong, to be inspired, to have a creative thought, and even to take a flight of fancy. As one Mongolian student explained, the word was best exemplified by the look in the eye of a horse that is racing where it wants to go, no matter what the rider wants. Despite the isolation of the Mongolian world, the tribes who lived there were not cut off entirely from the currents of world events. For centuries before the birth of Genghis Khan, Chinese, Muslim, Hindu, and Christian civilizations filtered into the Mongol homeland. Little of their culture proved adaptable, however, to the harsh environment of the high steppes. The nomadic tribes had distant but complex commercial, religious, and military relations with the constantly changing configuration of states in China and Central Asia. Living so far to the north, the Mongols were essentially out of range of the trade routes that later became known as the Silk Route, which ran south of the Gobi, tenuously and sporadically connecting Chinese and Muslim societies. Yet enough trade goods filtered north to make the Mongols aware of the treasures that lay in the south. For the nomads, trading with their neighbors and fighting with them constituted an interrelated part of the yearly rhythm of life, as customary and predictable as tending the newborn animals in the spring, searching for pastures in the summer, or drying meat and dairy products in the fall. The long, cold winter was the season for hunting. The men left home in small parties to roam the mountains and penetrate the forests, hunting rabbits, wolves, sables, elks, ibex, argali or wild sheep, boars, bears, foxes, and otters. Sometimes the whole community participated in hunts, where they would encircle as large an area as they could and drive the game toward a central slaughtering point. The animals provided not only meat, leather, and fur, but also antlers, horns, tusks, teeth, and bones that the nomads fashioned into a variety of tools, weapons, and decorations, and various dried organs that were used as medicines. The forest also supplied other goods for trade and daily life, including hunting birds that were taken from their nests in infancy. The nomads traded the forest products from family to family, gur to gur, toward the south, while manufactured products, such as metal and textiles, slowly moved north from the trading centers south of the Gobi. The Mongols survived on the most northern edge of this world, just at the juncture of the steppe and the northern Siberian forest. They lived as much through hunting in the forest as by herding animals on the steppe, and they exemplified the most extreme characteristics of both groups. They clung to the frayed ends of thin, delicate threads of trade, connecting the northern tundra and the steppe with the agricultural fields and workshops of the south. So few goods penetrated the far north that it was said that among the Mongols, the man with a pair of iron stirrups ranked as the highest lord. Some years the hunting was poor, and the people would grow hungry early in the winter, without a supply of forest products to trade. In those years, the Mongols still organized their hunting parties. Only instead of heading north into the forest to hunt animals, they moved out across the steppe to hunt for humans. If the Mongols had nothing to trade, they raided the herders they could find out on the steppe or in isolated valleys. The attackers used the same tactics in approaching human prey as animals. And at first sign of attack, the targeted victims usually fled, leaving behind most of their animals, the material goods of their homes, and whatever else the attackers might want. Since the object of the attack was to secure goods, the attackers usually looted the gurs and rounded up the animals rather than pursuing the fleeing people. Because the raiders wanted goods, casualties in this type of struggle remained low. Young women were kidnapped as wives, and young boys as slaves. Older women and the youngest children were usually exempt from harm, and the men of fighting age usually fled first on the swiftest and sturdiest horses, since they stood the greatest chance of being killed, and the future livelihood of the entire group depended so heavily on them. If the escaping men managed to summon allies quickly enough, they set off in pursuit of their attackers in an attempt to track them and recover their goods. If not, the defeated tribesmen rounded up as many of their animals as had managed to elude the captors, and they reorganized their lives as they nourished plans for their counterattack at a more propitious time. For the Mongols, fighting functioned as more of a cyclical system of raiding than of true warfare or even sustained feuding. Revenge often served as the pretext for a raid, but it rarely acted as the true motivator. Success in battle carried prestige for the victor based on the goods brought back and shared with family and friends. Fighting did not revolve around the abstract prestige of honor on the battlefield. Victorious warriors showed pride in their kills and remembered them. But there was no ostentatious collecting of heads or scalps, nor making notches or other emblems to represent the number of men killed in battle. Only the goods mattered, not the kill. Hunting, trading, herding, and fighting formed a seamless web of subsistence activities in the lives of the early Mongol tribes. From the time that he could ride, every male began to learn the skills for each of these pursuits, and no family could live off only one activity without the others. Raiding followed a geographic pattern originating in the north. The southern tribes that lived closest to the trade cities of the Silk Route always had more goods than the more distant northern tribes. The southern men had the best weapons, and to succeed against them, the northern men had to move quicker, think more cleverly, and fight harder. This alternating pattern of trade and raiding supplied a slow but steady trickle of metal and textile goods moving northward, where the weather was always worse, the grazing more sparse, and men more rugged and violent. Only a few details have survived from Temujin's earliest childhood, and they do not suggest that he was highly valued by his father. His father once accidentally left him behind when they moved to another camp. The Tayitshud clan found him, and their leader, Targite, the Fat Khan, took him into his own household and kept him for some time. Later in life, when Temujin became powerful, Targite boasted that he had trained Temujin with the same careful attention and loving discipline that he would train a colt, a herder's most prized possession. The details and sequence are unknown. But eventually, the child and his family were reunited, either because the Fat Khan returned the boy to them, or because the family joined the camp of the Fat Khan. The next known episode in Temujin's life occurred when his father took him in search of a wife at the early age of 9, by the Mongol count, 8 by the Western count. Yesuge and Temujin set out alone on the quest to find Oilun's family in the east, since perhaps Oilun wanted her son to marry a woman of her own tribe, or at least to know her family. More important than Oilun's preferences, however, Yesuge seemed to have wanted to be rid of him. Perhaps the father sensed the coming struggle that would erupt between his son Temujin and Begtur, the slightly older son, born to him by Sochigul, his first wife. By taking Temujin far away at this early age, the father probably sought to prevent the full eruption of the rivalry into trouble for his small family. With only a single extra horse to present to the parents of the prospective bride, Yesuge needed to find a family that would accept Temujin as a laborer for several years, in return for which they would give him their daughter in marriage. For Temujin, this trip probably was his first venture away from his homeland along the Onon River. It was easy to become lost in unfamiliar territory, and the traveler faced the triple dangers of wild animals, harsh weather, and, most of all, other humans. As things turned out, the father did not bother taking Temujin all the way to Oilun's family. Along the way, they stayed with a family whose daughter Bort was only slightly older than Temujin. The children apparently liked each other, and the fathers agreed to betroth them. During his time of apprenticeship or bride service, Temujin was expected to live and work under the protective eyes of his in-laws. Gradually, the intended couple would become ever more intimate. Because the girl was normally slightly older than the boy, as was the case with Borta and Temujin, she would initiate him into sexual intimacy, at the rate and in the timing that seemed appropriate to the two of them. On the long ride home alone after leaving Temujin, Yesuge happened upon an encampment where the Tatars were celebrating a feast. The secret history explains that he wanted to join the party, but he knew that he must not reveal his identity as the enemy who had killed their kinsman Temujin Ug in battle 8 years earlier. Despite his attempted deceit, someone is said to have recognized him and secretly poisoned him. Although quite ill from the poison, Yesuge managed to leave the Tatars and return home to his family's camp, whereupon he immediately sent a man to find and bring back Temujin, who had to leave Borta behind in the rush to his father's deathbed. By the time the boy arrived back at his family encampment, his father lay dead. Yesuge left behind 2 wives and 7 children under the age of 10. At the time, the family still lived along the Onon River with the Taichud clan. For the last 3 generations, the Taichud had dominated Yesuge's Borijin clan. Without Yesuge to help them fight and hunt, the Taichud decided they had little use for his 2 widows and their 7 young children. In the harsh environment of the Onon River, the clan could not possibly feed 9 extra people. By steppe tradition, one of Yesuge's brothers, who helped to kidnap Oilun, should have taken her as a wife. Under the Mongol system of marriage, even one of Yesuge's sons by his other wife, Sochigal, would have been an appropriate husband for her if he had been old enough to support the family. Mongol women often married much younger men in their deceased husband's family because it gave the younger man the opportunity to have an experienced wife without having to pay an elaborate set of gifts to her family or to put in the years of hard bride service. Although still a young woman, probably in her mid-20s, Oilun already had too many children for most men to support. As a captive wife, far from her homeland, she offered a potential husband neither family wealth nor beneficial family ties. With her husband dead, and no other man willing to take her, Oilun was now outside the family. And as such, no one had any obligation to help her. The message that she was no longer a part of the band came to her, the way Mongols always symbolize relationships, through food. In the spring, when 2 old crones, the widows of a previous Khan, organized the annual ceremonial meal to honor the family's ancestors, they did not inform Oilun, thereby cutting her off not only from the food itself, but from membership in the family. She and her family were therefore left to feed and protect themselves. As the clan prepared to move down the Onon River toward summer grounds, they planned to leave Oilun and her children behind. According to the secret history, as the band moved out, deserting the 2 women and 7 children, only a single old man from a low-ranking family in the band objected loudly to what they were doing. In an incident that apparently made a deep impression on Temujin, one of the deserting Taichud bellowed back to the old man that he had no right to criticize them, turned back, and speared the old man to death. Upon seeing this, Temujin, at this point a boy of no more than 10 years, is said to have dashed up to try to help the dying man. Unable to do anything, he just sobbed in hurt and anger. Oilun, who had shown such clear-headedness during her kidnapping a decade earlier, showed the same determination and strength during this new crisis. She made a violent and defiant last effort to shame the Taichud into keeping her family. As the clan deserted their encampment, she grabbed up the horsehair spirit banner of her dead husband, mounted her horse, and chased after them. Raising the spirit banner over her head and waving it furiously in the air, she circled the fleeing people. For Oilun to wave the banner of her dead husband was not merely to wave his emblem, but to parade his very soul in front of the deserting tribesmen. they indeed felt such shame in the presence of his soul, and fear of possible supernatural retribution from it, that they temporarily returned to the camp. Then they awaited nightfall, and, one by one, sneaked away, taking with them the family's animals, thereby condemning to a nearly certain winter death both widows and their 7 children. But the family did not die. In a monumental effort, Oi Lun saved them. All of them. As related in the secret history, she covered her head, tucked up her skirt, and ran up and down the river searching for food day and night in order to feed her 5 hungry children. She found small fruits and used a juniper stick to dig up the roots of the plants growing along the river. To help feed the family, Temujin made wooden arrows tipped with sharpened bones to hunt rats on the steppe, and he bent his mother's sewing needles into fish hooks. As the boys grew older, they hunted larger game. In the words of the Persian chronicler Juveni, who visited the Mongols 50 years later and wrote one of the first foreign accounts of the life of Temujin, the family wore clothing of the skins of dogs and mice, and their food was the flesh of those animals and other dead things. Whether precisely accurate or not, the description shows the desperate, isolated struggle of these social outcasts on the verge of starvation, living almost as much like animals as like the other tribes around them. In the land of harsh lives, they had fallen to the lowest level of steppe life. How could an outcast child rise from such a lowly station to become the Mongols' great Khan? Searching through the account of Temujin's coming of age in the secret history, we find crucial clues about the powerful role these early traumatic events must have played in shaping his character, and in turn, his rise to power. The tragedies his family endured seemed to have instilled in him a profound determination to defy the strict caste structure of the steppes, to take charge of his fate, and to rely on alliances with trusted associates, rather than his family or tribe, as his primary base of support. The first of these powerful associations was with a slightly older boy named Jamuka, whose family camped repeatedly nearby Temujin's on the banks of the Onon River, and as a member of the Jadaran clan, was distantly related to the clan of Temujin's father. In the ideals of Mongol culture, kinship reigned above all other social principles. Anyone outside the kinship network was automatically an enemy, and the closer the kin, the closer the tie should be. Temujin and Jamuka were distant relatives, but they wished to be closer, to become brothers. Twice in their childhood, Temujin and Jamuka swore an oath of eternal brotherhood, becoming blood brothers according to Mongol tradition. The story of this fated friendship, and the pivotal events of his life in this early period, reveal many telling details about Temujin's extraordinary ability to rise above adversity and marshal the resources he needed to ultimately tame the unbridled violence of tribe against tribe that ruled the steppe. Temujin and Jamuka formed a close friendship as they hunted, fished, and played the games the children were taught to improve their everyday skills. Mongol children, both boys and girls, grew up on horses. From infancy, they learned to ride with their parents or older siblings until, after only a few years, they managed to hold on by themselves and ride alone. Usually by age 4, children had mastered riding bareback, and eventually how to stand on a horse's back. While standing on the horse, they often jousted with one another to see who could knock the other off. When their legs grew long enough to reach the stirrups, they were also taught to shoot arrows and to lasso on horseback. Making targets out of leather pouches that they would dangle from poles so that they would blow in the wind, The youngsters practiced hitting the targets from horseback at varying distances and speeds. The skills of such play proved invaluable to horsemanship later in life. Other games included playing knuckle bones,